Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 4th, 2011, and this is show number 328. Well, I don't care if this is a holiday in the United States, the show must go on, and so we're here. Well, I cannot believe I forgot to tell you guys something really, really exciting last week. Have you ever heard of the Mac Mania Cruises? Captain Neil of Insight Cruises is the mastermind. He buys something like 300 rooms on a Holland America cruise ship that, say, holds 2,000 people. Then he arranges speakers on a specific topic. He's got ones on history, science, astronomy, or in this case, the Mac. Now, you pay an extra fee to go to the conference at sea, but you get sort of a private party feel on the ship. You eat meals and play with people all of the same interest. I've wanted to go on one of these cruises forever. Leah Laporte speaks on lots of them, and our good friend Don McAllister has spoken on the last few as well. Get this, I get to be one of the speakers on Mac Mania 15. Now, it's not until November of 2012, but I am so excited already. Leo and Don are also speaking, as is Wally Cherwinski. Don and I have to do most of the heavy lifting. Get this, we have to do 8 90-minute seminars. Isn't that insane? Now, Steve gets to go with me, but he gets the best deal. He gets the trip without any of the work. Of course, he'll have the job of talking me down off the ceiling for the last couple of weeks before we go, as I'm frantically trying to get prepared, because you can just tell I'm going to leave that to last minute getting prepared, right? You know, I freak out before vacations anyway, but this will be insanity. He may need to anesthetize me. Oh, wait, I forgot to tell you where Mac Mania actually goes, on Mac Mania 15, that is. It starts in Sydney, Australia, goes up the east coast of the continent, and then goes out to New Caledonia, a French-owned island off the coast, and then back down to Sydney. But get this, there's a sky and telescope group going on the same cruise because there's a total eclipse of the sun while we're on our way to New Caledonia. It's actually on the agenda. It says 7 p.m. cocktails and solar eclipse. How cool is that? Well, anyway, I put a link in the show notes to Insight Cruises where you can see, read all about the trip, and you can see what Don and I are going to be talking about. I hope maybe some of you guys could come. That would be so, so cool. I'm working on getting Captain Neil to come on the show and talk a little bit about what it's like and get us all excited about it. He can't for a while. I think it'll be sometime in October that he's going to come on the show and talk to us. Well, I have a couple of very important corrections to last week's show. Last week, I talked about the HP story, and I referred to the CEO as Leo Apotheker. I got a call from listener Dean to correct my pronunciation. He said the CEO's name is pronounced Leo Apotheker. There, did I say it right, Dean? So Dean knows this because he used to work for the man at SAP. Dean also said I could very well be right in my assessment of Leo as being smart like a fox. All right, mix up number two. I was alerted by Kevin Alder, also known as Big in Virginia on Twitter, and also known as Steve's wingman. I was alerted by him that my discussion with Rod Simmons last week, I inadvertently referred to Mark Shepard as my pusher, when in fact the real gear dealer who cost me a fortune is Mark Dalton. To be fair, the chat room during the live show is a veritable hive of Marks. In fact, I may just start calling everyone Mark to make it easier on me. In any case, my deepest apologies for any harm done to the character of one of the finest members of the NoSillaCast crew, Mark Shepard. Now, wait, now which one is Switcher Mark? And then there's Mark Greentree? There's so many Marks, it's killing me, I'm telling you. All right, while we're doing administrative stuff, I haven't mentioned the NoSillaCast news in a while. The show comes out pretty much like clockwork, so there's not always a big deal to chat about, but subscribing to the newsletter would let you know if anything big did happen, like my site being down or the feed being boogered, that sort of thing. If you subscribe using the easy little form on podfeet.com, you'll always know if things are going on swimmingly like usual or if something odd has occurred. I really encourage you to subscribe to the NoSillaCast news. You also get a weekly update saying that the show's posted, but heck, you know that's going to happen every week.
Hi, Allison and fellow NoSillaCastaways. This is Rod Simmons from the Simple Mobile Review Podcast. This week, I'd like to review a free app called Heytel. But first, as always, let's establish the problem to solve. Not everybody likes to text. I have no problem typing on a physical keyboard, on a BlackBerry, or a virtual keyboard on a screen. But some people would rather just use the spoken word to transit messages back and forth. And Heytel is actually a really cool and easy solution to do that. So you take two iOS users, they both download and install Heytel. It leverages your contact list, so I can grab anybody in my contact list that is registered also with Heytel, and I can verbally talk a message, and it sends that message over to them. So they get actually my spoken word. Delivery with Heytel is virtually instantaneous. So, for example, I have a friend who lives in Boise, Idaho. I hit the Heytel button, and I sent him a message and said, it's 2:55 my time. He got the message and said, it's 1:55 and 36 seconds my time. So seconds later, he actually received the message. The application couldn't be easier to use. There's no need for you to go around and set up username and password, which kind of makes you feel like it's a little bit insecure, but you can actually set up Heytel to say that I can communicate with anybody on the Heytel system, or you can have your privacy settings, which is the default, to say I only communicate with my friends and my friends' friends. So it's a really easy app to use. You can also go with a highly secure thing that says only communicate with people that you can contact or that are in your contact list. So it does make it easy for you to have some level of privacy. Again, it's a really easy app to use. There's tons of extras that they try to sell you for in-app purchases. But, you know, for a very simple app that allows you to take your contacts that are also IS users and send a voice message over to them and have a voice message sent back, it's almost like you can go back and forth because it's so instantaneous, like it's a walkie-talkie feature. Heytel, again, is a free download, costing you nothing. But for your friends who are also running iOS, if they have it, you can do voice communication back and forth without actually having to call.
Well, Rod, I've been having a blast with Heytel ever since I heard your review. I installed it and instantly started having voice conversations with Rod, and then I convinced my friend Diane to try it on her iPhone, and we had a blast with it too. I think she put it best. She said it's like a walkie-talkie, but you don't have to answer it immediately. She was really excited to find out that it's cross-platform since her son is on Android. I'm sure he'll be thrilled to get voice messages this way from his mom, right? We also noticed an interesting use case. We can't text while driving, not if we've got a single functioning brain cell in our heads, but if you leave Heytel open when you turn off your phone, it will play the messages immediately while you're driving. Then by simply holding your thumb down on the phone without even looking at it, you can answer. It seemed a lot safer than text messaging and accomplished the same thing. Of course, doing neither would be even safer while you're driving. I got Steve playing with it too, and we've been having a lot of fun. I'd be curious to see whether I'll use it in the long haul, but it's definitely an interesting thing to use. I put a link in Heytel in iTunes in the show notes so you can play with it too.
Hello, Allison. It's Jonathan Quinlan, or jquinlan96 on Twitter. The answer to Professor Rabbit's question, what is a kilobyte and does it byte, and if so, do you die from it? A kilobyte, meaning 1,000, is a unit of digital information storage equal to either 1,000 bytes or 1,024 bytes, depending on the context. The prefix of kilo refers to the number 1,000. This is a standard official definition used to measure hard drives, DVDs, network hardware, and etc. This is what Mac OS X and Linux use to measure disk and file sizes. Hope this helps. And to answer your question, Professor Albert, no, it doesn't bite, and no, you're definitely not going to die from it. Okay, thank you, Alison. Love the show as always. Bye.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. I'm sure that Professor Albert appreciates your help. Well, a few weeks ago, I reviewed a whole slew of wireless hotspots, and I finally settled on the Novatel MiFi 4G 4510L from Verizon. I liked everything about the device, except that it wouldn't charge and operate as a hotspot at the same time. I did some hunting around for a solution, and from a Verizon wireless message board, I discovered that you could hack the USB cable itself to fix the problem. Some people will tell you that a charge-only cable will work, but they're wrong. Turns out you have to cut the wire in half, strip back the insulation, strip back the wires on either side, and then short the green-white data pair in order to trick the device into working. Just not having those data wires there in the first place does not fix the problem. I decided to give it a try, and I was successful for only a couple of dollars. While I was doing it, I took a bunch of photos of my progress because I had a plan. I decided before I did it to create a Screen Steps tutorial to post to my blog so that I could teach other people how to do it. I mean, duh, right? What good is knowing stuff if you don't teach other people? Then I got to thinking how cool a video would be. But of course, a video of me stripping wires and soldering would not be all that interesting. What would be interesting, though, would be a demonstration of the behavior of the MiFi not working before the hack and working great after the hack. So I finally took advantage of a feature that's been in Screen Steps for ages and ages, and I embedded my video right into the Screen Steps lesson. I uploaded the video to YouTube, grabbed the embed code, and slapped it right into Screen Steps. Easy as pie. I published to my blog as a page so that can be one of my tutorials right from the menu bar of my website. I'd love it if you went and checked it out, even if you don't need to do this trick. I'm pretty proud of my little tutorial with my little video. I have so much fun, as you can tell, when I use Screen Steps. I really hope you'll check it out yourself. They have a free 30-day trial, so what do you have to lose? Check it out at screensteps.com. It's only $40 to be able to do what I did. You may also want to check out the free public beta for the Mac of their newest product, Clarify, from bluemangolearning.com/clarify. Oh, and that is an important distinction. Screen Steps runs on the Mac and Windows. I've mentioned several times that I purposely named the podcast with a very vague name so that I could talk about whatever fascinated me. I can talk about anything I want, and you can't say I'm off topic. Well, many years ago, I got an email from an engineering student in Peru named Paul Korswagen. Over the years, I've enjoyed hearing about his engineering degree work, very much like pen pals chatting. We just talk. Paul decided, in keeping with my talk about what interests me, that he'd teach us about seismic isolation. Let's hear him explain this technology subject.
Hi, Alison and fellow NoSilacast listeners. This is Paul from Peru, and I'm here with a brief and not too technical overview on seismic isolation. Since Alison likes to include a great variety of topics in her podcast, I thought she'd like a brief explanation of what seismic isolation is. Isolated buildings exist since the 80s, and if you live in a seismic area, you've probably used some seismic isolated structures, although probably just bridges. Japan is the world's leader in seismic isolation, with thousands of isolated buildings. First, to understand seismic isolation, we need a bit of background into structure and earthquake dynamics. Let's start with a practical example. Take a metallic ruler or any object that is rigid enough to stand upright and flexible enough to oscillate if you move it at the base. Now, wiggle its face and you'll notice that at a certain speed, frequency, the ruler will bend the most. If you wiggle its face really fast, it will probably not move much more than your hand, and perhaps the tip moves even less. Now, hold a pen to the ruler's top end and try to make it oscillate. It should now require a slower vibrating frequency to reach the maximum movement at the top. This is because every configuration has a specific frequency at which it would naturally vibrate if you were to give it a first impulse. A building is no different, so when an earthquake comes, it will vibrate differently depending on what frequency the earthquake has. If the natural frequency of the building were very different to the one of the earthquake, it would hardly move at all. And the more a building moves, or more precisely, the more adjacent stories move relating to each other, the more damage the structure will take. Windows will shatter, and plumbing will fail. Also, the harder a building vibrates, the more its contents will suffer. Shells will fall over, appliances and special equipment will break, etc. The problem is that buildings can't be constructed so that they have a specific natural frequency that avoids the earthquake's movement. First, it would be technically very difficult to build a structure with a frequency lower than 0.25 hertz. That means it moves back and forth one time in 4 seconds. Most buildings have a natural frequency between 1 and 10 hertz, which depends on their mass and their flexibility. Secondly, they don't necessarily have one predominant natural frequency, like the ruler, but can have a couple of important vibrating modes. Theoretically, they are an infinite number, so depending on how they're moved, they will vibrate taking different forms. Another problem is that earthquakes have a big range of frequencies. That means the Earth moves at many frequencies at the same time, usually from 0.3 Hz to 10 Hz. The range varies depending on the type of ground you're standing on and how the earthquake is produced. Earthquakes are different around the world. So, what is seismic isolation, you ask? The concept is very simple. You put the whole building on top of a device that deforms easily, think rubber, so that when the earthquake comes, the ground moves but the building stays relatively stationary because of its inertia. In the case of bridges, the flexible layer is installed between the deck and the piers. These isolation devices can actually include layers of rubber in such a way that they deform easily in one direction, but are stiff on its vertical direction. Otherwise, they would crush under the weight of the building. There are others that use friction or the principle of an inverted pendulum, but they all do the same thing, create a flexible layer between the ground and the structure. And how does this affect building dynamics? First, the system, isolation layer, building, can be designed so that its natural frequency is between a quarter and a half hertz. Most earthquakes on a good soil don't move slower than 1 hertz, so you can effectively have a building that almost doesn't move during an earthquake. Secondly, because the natural frequency of the building is very slow, when it moves, its contents won't be damaged. This is very important in buildings that house expensive equipment like servers and MRI-type machines. Thirdly, the isolated natural frequency of the building becomes strongly dominant, so there is no fear of the building taking other modes of vibrating. And fourthly, the isolation devices can add a bit of dampening to the structure, so that once it starts moving, it will try to stop quicker. Of course, seismic isolation has its compromises. There has to be a lot of space around the building in order for it to move, because with a flexible base, the building will move considerably more than a fixed-based one. Also, the plumbing and wiring connections must be able to take the distortion. The plane above the isolators must be rigid so that all isolators move the same. And price for the isolation devices is not yet justifiable for all types of buildings. Besides, isolation doesn't work everywhere. For example, if you were to build an isolated structure in Mexico City, it wouldn't help much, because the soil amplifies the earthquake's vibration at the slow end with a predominant frequency of half a hertz. Well, I hope I got you a bit interested in structures and earthquakes, and that you've enjoyed this article.
Well, thanks, Paul. This was fantastic. I bet no other podcast has had an explanation of seismic isolation before. I have a great story for you that goes right with this. When I was in graduate school, I took a rotation through our structural engineering organization at work. Our boss, Dr. Holman, thought I was an idiot. All right. Perhaps I'm not the number one engineer in the company, but I do all right, okay? I'm not a moron, but he thought I was. Many, many years later, I don't know, 10, 15 years later, when I was working in the design organization, someone designed a laser that was supposed to stand up on 4 legs as vibration isolators. They're supposed to be 4 metal legs. Now, wait, before I go on, I got to give you a bit of background, which it sounds like you would already know, Paul, but to make sure everybody else knows. So there's a natural frequency, which is very hard to calculate, but there's also something that talks about how much something will react when rung at its natural frequency. So that's called the Q of the system, which is essentially the multiplier to be applied when the device, or building in your example, hits that natural frequency. A tuning fork has a very, very high Q because it's got no damping at all. It just rings like crazy if you hit it at the right frequency. So a graph of amplitude on the vertical scale and frequency on the horizontal scale would give you a very tall but narrow spike right around that natural frequency. If you take a building, which has a lot of natural dampening, unlike a tuning fork, that same curve would be very short and wide, and it would have a very small value of Q. So back to my mechanical vibration analysis, we build these very elegant models of the structure. We run it through very, very expensive software to analyze its characteristics under dynamic conditions. And we have all this hardware, it's software, modeling. And right before the analyst starts the job on the computer, he or she guesses at Q. Yeah, they guess. All this money and time and everything they spend and everything else, you guess at what Q is. So they almost always guess that Q is 10, because Q is usually around 10. So back to our little laser sitting up on its 4 little metal legs. Dr. Holman, for some reason, was taken out of mothballs and asked to do the analysis. He guessed that Q was 10, and he ran the analysis. Everything said it was fine. They built the model, they took it down to the vibration lab, and they started shaking it. And almost instantly, all 4 legs snapped right off, and the laser shot across the room. Turned out Q was 100. Well, the reason I love this story was that the design organization, of which I was now a part, was asked to come in and figure out what could possibly have gone wrong. I was assigned to the project. It was awesome. In 10 minutes of looking at the design, I found at least 3 major flaws. They had sharp corners, no surface finish, they chose the wrong materials, and of course, there was no dampening material. It was as if they had put the laser up on 4 poorly made tuning forks. So you can see this is a subject near and dear to my heart. It's probably been 25 years since that happened, and I still smile at the thought that I was called to come in and fix Dr. Holman's mistakes. Every once in a while, you find a software developer who consistently creates outstanding products. There are a lot of great developers out there, don't get me wrong, but one-hit wonders are far more frequent than companies that relentlessly create quality products. One of these companies is Telestream from Telestream.net. I've reviewed many of their programs, most recently Wirecast 4 that allows me to create my live show and broadcast it to multiple services like Justin.tv, supports HD video, lower thirds, all kind of cool features that give the impression that I'm a professional. This time I'm going to talk to you about their screencasting software, ScreenFlow. Bart first reviewed ScreenFlow back in 2008. I reviewed ScreenFlow 2 in 2009, and now we have ScreenFlow 3. I have to tell you, when I first heard that ScreenFlow 3 was coming out, I tried to figure out what they could do to make it better. You may know that I'm saddled with Windows at work, so all my screencasting there has to be done using Camtasia Studios. It's horrible. It's clunky. It's buggy. It loses data. It's unpredictable. And it even gets voice and video out of sync. And it takes forever to encode on a workstation-class machine. And to top it all off, it costs $300. Other than that, I'm really quite fond of it. I really do like it. Now, consider ScreenFlow that's beautiful and elegant, intuitive, actually works, and it's only $99. If you're a fan of ScreenFlow and have version 2, you'll also be interested in this review since the upgrade cost is only $30 to go from version 2 to version 3. Like I said, I enjoyed the ScreenFlow experience so much, I was wondering what else could they do to improve it. They've included a laundry list of new features. The first and possibly most important thing is that they've upgraded to support Lion features like autosave, version control, and full screen capability. That by itself is worth the $30, but let's see what else it can do. I find it really useful on my videos using the craptastic Camtasia, when I can beat it into submission, to include annotations. Since this is screencasting software, it makes sense that from time to time you'd want to highlight an area, draw a box around it, put a big giant arrow pointing to the thing you're trying to explain on screen, a la screen steps, right? But in video. ScreenFlow 3 adds that capability. You can freehand draw lines with all kinds of endpoints and draw filled or transparent boxes or circles around items to grab the viewer's attention. One thing I wish they'd included, and perhaps I just didn't find it, would be the ability to create a highlight box, like a translucent yellow box. I couldn't change the opacity of the boxes in the annotations. However, they do have a callout function that provides most of this functionality. In callouts, you can either have your cursor surrounded by a circle to show exactly where you're pointing, or you can draw a freehand rectangle. When you create a callout, it automatically makes the rest of the video darker, so it highlights the callout area. Now, I had trouble getting some of this function to work properly. One of the options is to blur the background, but it repeatedly blurred what was inside my callout as well. I'm certain that's not the desired behavior, so it looks like I just ran into a little bug. It did only happen one time. Creating text boxes is super fun. If you have artistic talent, you can use the tools they provide to add gradient fills to the text and the background of the callout, play with the fonts, add outlines to the text. Now, I say you have to have actual artistic talent because when I did it, I managed to make this nasty-looking green box with purple to kind of a puke green gradient on the text and puke orange background. Art is definitely not my talent, that's for sure. Well, I was going to say in the review that I wanted an enhancement to be able to add transitions to text boxes, but I kept poking at it, and I finally figured out how to do it. If you hover over the text box in the timeline, you'll see a little gear, and sure enough, right there, you can add transitions. A little while later, I realized that you can right-click on any kind of clip, including text clips, and get to the transitions. I should have assumed that Telestream wouldn't leave me wanting. There are a ton of enhancements to video editing that I didn't even get a chance to test, like how you can reorder, delete, and resize the height of your tracks, group clips, insert gaps, and select and remove gaps. They've also added audio quality controls, like the ability to remove background noise and to smooth volume levels. You can view the audio waveforms and increase the size visually so you can see what you're doing. I talk to friends of mine who are blind, and they find it really funny that I have to be able to see to edit audio. They think that's hysterical, but it really helps to be able to see the waveform, I think. This lets you see where your audio peaks and then view those peaks as you modify the audio with quality controls. I really enjoyed messing around with the audio. You know, I'm an audio person, right? I'm not sure I would use a lot of the effects for the kind of work I do. Like, you can make it sound like you're in a great big hall or a small room, those kinds of things. But I can see how well, you know, that would help certain people. And I was astonished at how well the remove background noise filter worked. I was messing around with a video for a friend of mine where they were filming outside. And I didn't even realize that there was a wind noise going on throughout. It was just kind of going and as soon as I hit that remove background noise filter, it was gone. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. It was really, really well done. The great thing about ScreenFlow is that you get pretty much instant gratification on all of the effects. In just a few seconds, you can listen to the change the filter or effect made, and they give you a cool animation on the audio waveform to entertain you while you are waiting. You can publish from ScreenFlow directly to YouTube, Vimeo, Flash, or to your disk using some nice presets like the one for viewing on the iPad they just added. You know, if you want to ruin your life, though, you can go into the custom settings and start fiddling around. Don't do it. I promise you, it's just a sinkhole of time, and it'll end up worse than what you started with. All right, it's time for the bottom line. I've tested out a fair number of video editors, even been playing with Final Cut Pro 10 this week, and by far, ScreenFlow is my favorite. I really wish I had ScreenFlow at work, that's for sure. ScreenFlow is fairly priced at $100, lower than Camtasia for Mac, way lower than Camtasia for Windows. If you've got ScreenFlow 2, the $30 upgrade is a no-brainer, even if it's only to get autosave and versioning from Lion, for Lion. I can, without reservation, recommend ScreenFlow from Telestream.net. Now, it's time for a confession. I told you earlier about a video I produced to embed in the Screen Steps tutorial on hacking the MiFi charging cable. Remember that? Well, I tried to create it in Final Cut Pro 10, but the titles kept giving me fits, and I found that certain things seemed very unpredictable. I probably spent 2 hours on it, and while I learned a lot, I was still kind of frustrated. I also had Bart try to convince me that iMovie has an intuitive interface. I could not disagree more. The lack of a linear timeline drives me batty. Then I get a crazy idea. What if I tried to use ScreenFlow to do it? I know, ScreenFlow is a screencasting app, but it turns out you can instantly drag in any video clip, which takes forever in iMovie, by the way, takes zero time in ScreenFlow. You can add transitions, you can add titles, you can drag in music, you can edit in a lovely timeline view, and guess what? It worked perfectly. In less than an hour, I had my movie complete and ready to export to disk. Even the export took way less time than all the other tools. So don't tell this Telestream guys, but ScreenFlow is a fantastic simple editor for making movies too. Well, I've asked you guys to tell me how you use Text Expander from Smile over at smilesoftware.com, and Ken Wolf gladly wrote the following testimonial. I think he's actually more passionate about Text Expander than I am, and I'm pretty passionate about it. Here's what he wrote. This is Ken Wolf from Manhattan Repertory Theater in New York City. I was listening to your podcast today as you talked about one of the many uses of Text Expander, and I thought I'd let you know about how I use Text Expander and how it saves me literally thousands of keystrokes per day. Here at Manhattan Rep, we produce a lot of new theater. Over 6 years, we've produced over 600 plays, so that averages out to about 100 plays a year. All our communication with the creative teams putting together new plays is done by email. Of course, I use the standard signature snippet, but what I do every day to save copying time and thousands of keystrokes is to use Text Expander for entire letters. For play submissions, we have a standard Text Expander letter. 4 keystrokes and a 300-word letter appears. When we receive contracts and release forms, again, another Text Expander snippet creates a response letter. When we accept plays for our theater festivals, I use a combination of Text Expander snippets for different parts of the body of the letter and another for the subject heading. I have probably 20 different response letters with easy-to-remember snippets. Text Expander is awesome. At any given time, we can be dealing with up to 60 creative teams, and Text Expander helps me speed through Manhattan Rep's email, giving me time to do all the other myriad of things that need to be done to run a successful indie theater in New York City. Honestly, I would pay $500 for Text Expander. $34.95 is a bargain for all the time I save. To have a computer without Text Expander is like running a marathon without sneakers. It's just plain silly. Text Expander is awesome. Your podcast could not be supported by a better product. With best regards, Ken Wolf, Artistic Director, Manhattan Repertory Theater. Well, I guess I don't need to add anything to that. It sure seems like he's a fan. Head on over to smilesoftware.com and pick yourself up a copy of Text Expander. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz. How are you today, Bart?
We'll just say fine. That's easier.
I guess I'm the one who's been sick this week. Sorry to steal your thunder on that. I know that that's been your domain for so long. But I'm surviving now, so that's good.
I haven't completely surrendered that domain, but let's not go into it.
All right. Well, someday, we can always hope. Well, I wanted to start out by talking about something real quick before Security Light. You were on the Mac Roundtable this week. What a fabulous show. That was really, really good.
It was fun. It had been a while since I'd been on, and we had a really good panel. Of course, it was long because, well, Steve Jobs left and, you know, that.
Right.
And so it was not a short show. It was sort of an IMP length show, really. But it was fun.
It's also hard to wrangle five panelists like you did. You did a great job. But having five people who all want to talk, that was pretty tough. But I thought it was really, really good. One thing I was curious about, you know, when Lion came out, you weren't wild about the idea of the desktops because you said as a power user that you really like spaces, and now you're sold on desktops. I wanted to ask you about one thing that's driving me crazy. And for anybody who's not on Lion, this is basically where you can do a four-fingered swipe up and you can see a bunch of different desktops and you can move your applications from desktop to desktop. You can slide between them and all this kind of stuff. It's really cool. Cool. Have you seen the behavior I've seen where I get something lined up? Like, let's say I've got Feeder on the window on the left and the desktop to the left, and to the right of that, I've got, say, Chrome. And I want to be able to switch back and forth between them, and all of a sudden they swap order.
Okay. What you want to do is you want to go into System Preferences.
Yeah.
And you want to go to the preference for Mission Control.
Oh, that's what that thing is called, is Mission Control?
Yes. Well, Expose plus Spaces has now been morphed into Mission Control.
Okay.
Then the third checkbox down is Automatically Rearrange Spaces Based on Most Recent Use. You want to uncheck that, and then sanity is restored.
Oh, thank you. Because I was like all excited. I had it all organized, and it was like, well, that was really annoying.
Yeah, I don't like that default option, so I uncheck that now. Sanity has returned.
One of the other things that bugs me is I've ended up with an application kind of split between two desktops, and then I can't ever figure out where stuff is. Like, I'll open Feeder in one window, and I'll have the main library of Feeder there, but then I'll take the Feeder file I'm working on, I'll move it to another one. And then when I do like a command tab, it's confused about what window to go to, but I suppose that's something I just got to get used to.
Well, if you click on the dock icon, you'll cycle through the two spaces that it's in. So I have the Finder in lots and lots of spaces, and as I click on the Finder icon, why isn't that working now?
Oh, yeah.
That's funny.
See, I actually don't use the dock.
I've always done that, and now it's not working.
Oh. I don't use the dock for anything.
It has its uses. The other thing you can always do is just, you know, pick up the apps icon and drop it all into the one window, and then you're fine.
Yeah. Yeah, especially with a Finder, like you say, that's where I get messed up a lot, where I don't want to go to another window for the Finder. I want the Finder to be here, but it's opening in another one, and I need it here. Get a little confused.
Well, I need Finder windows everywhere. I can't. There's no task I can do without a Finder window, so I have Finder windows everywhere.
So you just reopen it in each one?
No, I just right-click on the Finder icon in the dock and say New Window, and then that one will be in that space.
Okay.
You can always pick them up, and if you're holding onto a window as you switch between spaces, say using Control and the arrow keys, then the window will go with you.
Okay.
And you can also do Control 1, Control 2, Control 3, Control 4.
Well, here's one I wonder whether you know. And by the way, I didn't know Control arrow keys does it. I've been doing the three-fingered swipe back and forth. But is it three? No, four?
It's three fingers on a mouse, which means it's probably... it's two fingers on a mouse, so it's three fingers for you.
It's four fingers.
Well, generally speaking, it's one more finger on a touchpad than on a mouse.
Right.
But it's two fingers for me.
That's bizarre. One thing I found out through one of the message boards I'm on, did you know you can have every desktop have a different desktop background?
Yes, I did.
It's beautiful because I was trying to decide between a bunch of cool pictures I took on vacation, and then I found out I don't have to choose. I can just be flipping between them. I like it.
Well, what I've done is I've set all of my desktops to a random picture from a folder, which changes every 30 minutes because I have more than four pictures and I have four desktops.
I have more than four pictures, too.
You know, I have more than four that I really, really want. Oh. So I have them just set the cycle. So I just have a folder called desktops.
Okay.
And I just have all of my four desktops set the cycle through that randomly.
Well, I guess we better actually start the show here. I just wanted to ask a couple of questions about that. So that's cool. That's good. I'm glad to see you're enjoying it. All right.
And so you're one of the many people who never, ever touched Spaces and are now happy with...
I absolutely touched Spaces over and over and over again and hated it every time.
Exactly. So you were not a regular user, but now that we have Mission Control, you're happy to use that.
Yeah. Now that you showed me that checkbox, I'm even more likely to use it because that ruined it for me. I was like, oh, come on.
And have you taken to full screening apps yet?
Not so much.
Okay. Some apps are very suited to it, others aren't. I like to have iTunes as a full screen sitting off to the side because then I can really see stuff.
Yeah.
But different people have different choices. Some people like to have their mail client full screened, and then you just have an entire desktop for mail, and it's nice and big and easy to see.
There's a lot of times I would have liked full screen, but the problem is I'm very frequently sitting at my desk with my external monitor attached, and when I do that, it goes not to my external monitor where I had the window, but it goes to my internal desktop monitor, my laptop monitor. And I don't
want
that.
It'll go to whatever one you've set as the primary.
Yeah, but... Okay, so but if I want to go to full screen, I don't want the external monitor as primary. I want the internal as primary.
Yeah, multi-screens.
Full screen on the other one.
Yeah, multi-screen on the Mac is not so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It never has been. It's always been a bit odd.
Well, it's better than Windows, at least.
I know people who'll argue with you on that. I live with one.
Yeah, okay.
Let's not go there, though.
The Vista years... where external monitors were just a random little thing it would do, where it would just decide, I'd be working along and all of a sudden it would go, I know you had those monitors up and down from each other, but we've decided you want right and left now. Or while someone was, people have been watching my monitor when it's done this, where it would just switch which one was primary, it would change the resolution to 640 by 480. I mean, it would do it while I wasn't even touching the keyboard. So I'm going to keep my mouth shut and stop complaining about the way the Mac does it.
Okay, then.
All right. Well, we're in danger of actually starting the show here. Why don't we kick in with security? Is it light this week?
It's quite light, but it's a bit of a drama all the same.
Oh, okay.
So the whole security world is a Twitter because someone found in the wild an SSL cert for star.google.com that was not actually valid. Or sorry, that was valid but was not legally obtained.
So what does that mean to a normal person?
Well, the whole of our, SSL, that little padlock means anything, is based off of the notion that the root certificate authorities are trustworthy.
Right.
Because any certificate that's signed by one of the trusted root certificates in your computer is trusted.
Right.
So we are trusting these certificate authorities to not give out fraudulent certs. And something has gone wrong with a Dutch registrar called DigiNotar. And they're quite a big Dutch registrar, and they do stuff for the Dutch government as well, which is not good. But somehow, whether it was through some sort of social engineering attack or through an actual hack, there is a star.google.com cert issued by DigiNotar out there. It was not issued to Google. It was not issued to Google, exactly.
Ooh.
And DigiNotar is a trusted CA, or certificate authority, on every major browser. So what that meant was that anyone who had this fraudulent certificate could do a man-in-the-middle attack and decrypt your encrypted traffic, read it, and re-encrypt it without you noticing that anyone had been in the middle, which should be impossible. But it becomes possible when they have a valid certificate for Google.com.
Ooh. Valid and fraudulent.
Yeah, valid, as on a technical level, but fraudulent, as in it should not have been given. But
so,
it was.
Did DigiNotar also have a real .google.com cert?
No, because they're not Google's certificate authority.
Oh, okay.
Google paid like VeriSign or someone to do their cert.
Okay.
It's like any certificate authority can issue you a cert, but as part of the process, they are meant to prove that you are the valid owner of your domain, and there's a whole process to that.
So does that mean there's two certs out there, a real one and a fake one?
Exactly. Yeah, so Google have their own cert, and their own cert is still perfectly valid, and it's from a different certificate authority. Mm-hmm. And then somehow the DigiNotar root cert was used to sign another Google cert that is not property of Google Inc. and is out there. And Google say they have evidence of it being used in Iran to spy on political activists.
Oh, dear.
So they would try to securely use Gmail to coordinate against the tyrannical government, and the tyrannical government would be using that cert to spy on them and probably arrest them and take them away and do nasty things to them. So it's quite serious.
So this is, I'm going to sound dense here, but if there's two certs out there, which one is my computer using?
Your computer isn't using any cert. The way the certs come into it is you connect to a web server claiming to be google.com, and that server will hand you a cert.
Oh, okay,
and your computer will then verify that cert against the root certificates that you have on file. So the cert will be signed by a root certificate, and you have a copy of all the root certificates that you trust on your computer, and you will do a match, and you say, does this certificate actually sign this cert? Yes, therefore I trust this cert. So there could be an infinity of Google certs, and they could all be trusted, assuming they're signed by one of your root CAs.
So if I went to the real Google.com, I would get the real cert. But if I went to tyrannicalgovernment.google.com, I might get the other one?
Yes. Or you would think you would go to the real Google. You would think you were going to the real Google, but they run, say, you know, the firewall that's between you and the rest of the world, which is very true in a country like Iran. They could have the fake cert installed at their firewall through which your traffic has to pass.
Oh.
And they could use that fake cert to do a man-in-the-middle attack. And so they would contact Google with Google's real cert, but you would be talking to them with the fake cert, but you would think you were talking to Google because the cert matches.
Okay. I'm not being dense on this. Is a little complicated.
No. It is complicated.
Okay.
So the bottom line is that the solution, clearly, is to not trust DigiNotar certs, and then you won't be affected by this. So there has been a flurry of updates. Microsoft have done an update where they have stripped the DigiNotar root certificate out of the operating system. And
wow.
I.e. uses the operating system store, so I.e. instantly does no longer trust DigiNotar. Google Chrome have issued an update where they strip it out of Google Chrome's store of certificates. Firefox has done an update where they strip it out of Firefox's store of certificates. And the one name missing from that list is Apple, who have yet to act.
Oh, jeez. So they need to pull it out of the operating system? It's not out of the browser?
Well, it depends, right? Internet Explorer does not have its own store. Because it's built into the OS, it uses the OS-level store. On the Mac, Safari does not carry its own store. It uses the OS-level store in your keychain.
When you say store, you mean like storage place, not place you buy things?
Well, a store of certificates, yeah.
Okay.
It's called a store, yeah.
Okay.
It stores them as in a shed rather than storing it as in a place that sells stuff.
Great. Okay, good.
But third-party browsers tend to prefer to manage their own store rather than to use an OS-wide one. So Firefox, no matter what operating system you're using on, it ignores the operating system store and has its own store.
So if you're on the branch, the 3.x branch or the 4. The what are we at, 48.x branch of Firefox now,
you need to be on 3.6.21 or 6.1 or 6.0.1.
Okay. Unless they've updated while we've been talking.
Which is always possible, but if you're on those, at least you have the DigiNotar cert taken out. So if you're a Windows user and you're fully patched, then you're going to be golden. If you're a Linux user and you're using Firefox or Chrome, you're going to be golden, assuming you've patched. And on the Mac, you're perfectly fine, assuming you're not a Safari user and that you're fully patched.
Wow.
So Safari will use the operating system level store of certificates. So if you do insist on using Safari, despite a million reasons not to, then if you feel brave, you can manually go and strip that certificate out of your operating system if you like. So to do that, you go to Applications, Utilities, Keychain Access, and then under Category, so you choose the login keychain, under Category, you can pick All Items, and then if you type DigiNotar into the search box, a cert should show up. And you might also want to repeat that on the system roots keychain. Let me just try that and see how many show up. DigiNotar root certificate. There's one certificate is all that shows up.
Hmm.
And then you would right-click and you would delete DigiNotar root CA. I'm not doing it on my machine because I want to see when Apple do it. So I'm leaving it there. If you want to do that, you can do that. It may have side effects. It may not. But I'm just saying, that's how you would do it if you wanted to. Hmm. Or you could use Chrome or Firefox, and you're perfectly fine.
Okay, so for our friends and family that we take care of, we ought to probably switch them over to Firefox if we haven't done already, or Chrome?
Yeah, I have my family running off Chrome because it's the safest browser out there. It packages its own flash. It does silent updates in the background. It's very hard to have an insecure version of Chrome. It takes effort.
Really?
Ah. Well, because it auto-updates. And because it bundles its own flash. You can't even be walloped by not updating your flash. Hmm. It is the single safest browser as far as I'm concerned.
Unless they were to become like Apple and stop updating flash.
But no, but they have taken on responsibility for that. So it is a choice they have made for a security reason, and they tend to get updates out quicker than Adobe themselves.
Hmm.
So they tend to have a better flash than if you use the official flash.
So does this mean a company like DigiNotar is out of business?
It's a big knock for them. I wouldn't want to be a shareholder.
Yeah, but I mean, if the solution is to just delete DigiNotar from every operating system and browser...
Well, no, it's that cert. So what DigiNotar will now have to do is create a new root certificate, re-sign all of their certificates, give all of their customers new certificates, and then get the browsers to accept their new cert back into the browsers.
Okay, so this is, in theory, temporary.
Yeah, but it's a knock to your reputation if you're a security provider.
It's like on a level of
damage. It's like when RSI were hacked a few months ago.
Right.
It is
RSA,
a day that we've had in the entire history of the company. It will always be remembered.
I think you meant RSA, not RSI, right?
RSA, yeah, that'll be the ones, yeah. I'm not sure what RSI is, apart from a horrible thing that happens to your wrists.
Exactly. Wow.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal, but basically, don't use Safari and you're fine.
Hmm.
And I'm sure Apple have an update in the works, but being Apple, they haven't told us it's coming. It'll just appear.
Right. You'll have to know when it happens. All right, well, you keep us up to date when it does.
I most certainly will. The other thing I just want to mention, and it's just a little quick one-liner, is as always happens when something happens, there is a whole bunch of phishing emails I've read about Hurricane Irene. So just be careful.
Oh, you mean the kind where they're saying, here, give us money, we're going to give it to the Irene victims?
Whereas in actual fact, they're stealing your credit card and taking all of your money. Yeah, those kind, yeah.
Nice.
Such lovely people. anyway, so that's that.
All right, so let's see. I wanted to bring up the next one. On Mark's Not Another Mac podcast, we had John F. Braun, Kirshen, and Jody Spangler talking. Great show, by the way. I put a link in the show notes to it. And Jody Spangler gave an interesting lion tip. She said she was taking care of a client who'd forgotten his password. She said she was able to boot the Lion machine holding down Command-R, which booted her into the recovery partition. And from there, she was able to run the password utility and get into the machine. Now, that didn't sound too secure to me. And one of my questions was, when we talk about whole disk encryption with File Vault 2, is that physical disk or is that the virtual disk, the partition disk that's been whole disk encrypted, or is it the whole physical disk, if I said that correctly?
Okay, I guess the first thing to say, if you have physical access to a machine that is not encrypted, you can generally reset system passwords because what you do is you delete the password that's there. What's stored is a hash, as we've talked about before,
mm-hmm.
and you will never be able to know what their password was, but if you reset the hash to nothing or to a hash that you know, then you can log in.
Okay.
But for that to work, you have to be able to write to the hard drive. And if the hard drive is encrypted, you can't.
So
it doesn't matter whether it's the partition or whether it's disk as a whole. It doesn't matter. If where your operating system keeps your passwords is on an encrypted partition, be it part of a whole drive, be it a disk image, it doesn't matter. If your operating system is on an encrypted file system, it is indistinguishable from random noise until you provide the password for the disk encryption. No utility can bypass that.
As opposed to what I'm talking about, which is the password for the operating system. It's not the encryption password.
Yes, but if you do not have the encryption password, you can do nothing. Right, none of these tools can
work. I'm agreeing with you, Bart. I'm not arguing. I'm agreeing. I'm just trying to be distinct in what I'm saying because this is important. So what Jody was talking about was the password for the operating system, not the password or for the user.
And what you can do is you can reset that, assuming the disk is not encrypted.
Right.
So because what you're literally doing is you're replacing the hash that's in there. You can't tell what the password was, but you can set it to a known password by copying in a hash that you know what it is.
Okay. So we would never even get to this ability on an encrypted disk, because you'd have to put the encryption password in before you could even get to this utility?
I'm not sure. It would depend on where the encryption is, but you could never get to the point where you could write a new hash in there. You could never get to the point where you could reset the password.
Okay.
Because you could never write to the disk.
Do you know whether FileVault is encrypting the physical entire disk or whether it's just doing the partition?
To be honest, I would imagine it's doing the system partition because that makes the most sense, because otherwise it would completely break boot camp and everything else.
Okay.
It would be very cheeky of OS X to decide that the entire disk is for it to do with as it pleases rather than just its partition.
Are you curious enough to try booting your machine into Command R to see where it goes?
I am, but not right now. Because
right now would probably would be a beautiful choice. Okay. All right, good.
Yes, so I can indeed do that, but I will have to report back.
All right. Sounds
but
good.
It doesn't really matter, though, because if the OS is encrypted, you can't use this utility slash attack, depending on how you view it.
Okay. All right. Well, it is interesting to know that you can get in there and change your root password without having the root password. That was still interesting to me.
Well, yes, but if you think about it, what you're doing is you're replacing the hash with a hash you know. It's a trick that you've been able to do in every operating system forever.
Yeah, I just never knew OS X could even do that.
It's not just OS X. You can do it on Windows. You can do it on anything.
Okay.
I can give you boot disks that will reset the Windows password in any Windows machine.
Hmm. Interesting. All right. Well, now on to yet another topic. Pierre Bourgeois, did I do it right, Pierre? He sent me a pronunciation link again.
Sounded French.
He had sent in a dumb question. He said, here's a potential dumb question for you. In troubleshooting problems for myself or others, the solution is oft times to delete the plist file and relaunch the software. Heck, we did that today, right, Bart? I did it. I had to do it on
YouTube. You did, actually, yeah.
For some reason, the recording window disappeared, and I couldn't get it back. But anyway, he says, this does often fix whatever's the particular mysterious ailment. I do not know what a plist file is and did some research with the Google, but the explanations are over the head of this wannabe techie. Remember, I'm an accountant by trade, so this limits my geekiness. My dumb questions are, what is a plist file? Why does it get mucked up? And why does deleting the file fix certain problems with software? Now, I started to research this to come up with the answer, and I thought, why don't I just let Bart spoon-feed me? It's always easier that way, right?
But it is for you.
Oh, good point.
As it happens, I know what a plist file is, so it wasn't much work. I just checked a few little minor details. The first thing to say is plist stands for property list, and it's a way of storing what we call key-value pairs. Now, what we mean by key-value pairs is a piece of data what has a name. So a key-value pair could be XY coordinates of your window. Would be, you know, you would save it as main window XY, and the value would be X, Y.
Okay.
That would be a key-value pair. Your username for Gmail would be a key-value pair stored inside mail.app. Your password for Gmail would be a key-value pair, and so on and so forth. So any piece of information that a program needs to store would be a key-value pair. It would give the information a name and then stick a value in it.
Okay.
So whenever Apple have provided APIs for the plist format...
API stands for Application Programmable Interface.
Yes. So if you're writing a program for the Mac or for iOS... and you don't want to reinvent the wheel, the simplest way to store information in a file, configuration information in a file, is to use plists, because Apple have given you all the functionality and you don't have to write your own. You just say, write plist, and you tell it what property to write and what value to write, and it takes care of the formatting. So that's why you'll see plists used a lot, because it's the official Apple-supported way of saving this kind of information.
Okay.
In fact, I say it's the Apple way. It's older than that. It was. It's one of the many things OS X has inherited from Next Step.
Right. But they did some changes after Next Step, right?
They changed the file format, but not the concept of the file. So they haven't changed what it does, or even particularly the APIs. But what they have changed is how the file is saved on the hard disk.
Okay.
And in the old Next Step days, it was a binary format, which meant it was hard to edit. And then when they started OS X, as in 10.0. They made it an XML file, which is human readable, so you could open it up in any random text editor and you could see all the angle brackets and stuff. It looks very like HTML, XML.
Really?
And
so
you could edit it manually.
So we can open our plist files and look at them and muck about in them?
Yes-ish. So that in 10.0, 10.1, that was definitely the case. However, XML is bloated. If you want to make information big, save it in XML. Pretty good way to make it take up more space than it needs to.
Okay.
And there's a lot of plists around the place, so developers were cranky, and Apple said, oh, all right, then we'll create a new binary format. So a binary format is much more space efficient, but not able to be read by humans. So okay. plists can be XML or they can be binary. Both are valid. And it's up to the developer which format they'd like to use. So some of your plist files can be read as XML, some can't. However, if you install Xcode, which, to be honest, I always do on every Mac because it's full of great little utilities, then you can simply open any plist file in Xcode and it will not show you the content. It will show you the data stored in the file rather than what's written in the file. So you will get rows and columns, and each row will tell you the name of the key, the data type, and the value stored in it. And so you can just scan down, and so I have a random one open here for Evernote, and it says my username, type string, and then it gives a value. It says stuff like incoming email address, application bundle path / application / Evernote.app, and all of this information that Evernote needs to run is all just in here. And because I'm opening an Xcode, I'm not seeing it as XML, I'm seeing it as the actual data.
Okay. So you get to see what it, not necessarily what it means so much, but you can see it, right?
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, it's just information that an app needs to run, and that's really all it's for. And Xcode is free, and you can get it from the App Store. It gives you lots of cool stuff to add to your Mac, so I always do it on machines.
Okay.
So that's sort of the what. To give you some sort of idea how common these things are, because they're everywhere, right, on your Mac. I stuck a little terminal command in the show notes, which will find every file named anything.plist in your home directory, and it's only for your home directory. And when I ran it on just my account on my Mac, it came back at 1,934.
Jesus. Okay.
Right? Now,
but you don't have 1,934 applications.
No, but there's no one-to-one mapping.
Ah, okay.
If you take the terminal command and you lob off the end of it, so you just end it after the T and P list, it will list them for you, and you can look at them. And there's loads and loads and loads of them. Every iMovie project has a P list file to describe that project. And, I mean, they're everywhere because basically they're the Mac equivalent of the Windows registry. So the Windows registry is a system wide way of storing key value pairs. Only in Windows, it's not one per app, it's one for the whole system, which means that every single setting for every single app you've ever installed ever is always in memory. So the more software you install, the slower Windows gets. Okay. If just installing it and never using it bloats your registry, and your registry has to be in RAM at all times, which is why Windows is stupid. It's one of the stupidest things Microsoft ever did, and it was purely done to make it harder to steal software. Because in the olden days, it used INI files.
I thought I remembered Steve Gibson saying that he had talked to them early on about not doing that.
I'm sure he had, because he's a sensible chap. In the olden days, Windows was like the Mac, and every app had a .ini file, which is their equivalent of a plist file.
Oh, okay. Right.
And then if you wanted to copy an app, you take its binary, i.e. the equivalent of its .app file, which was a folder in Windows, and you took its .ini file, and then you had the app. Whereas that was obviously too easy for people, so Microsoft went, ah, ha, ha, we're going to make this complicated, and that way it's harder to pirate software. And so they invented the system-wide registry, which means that all settings for all apps are loaded in one big go and wasting all of your RAM. Whereas on the Mac, the plist isn't loaded until the app is loaded.
Now, one thing, I guess this, we'll get into this when we talk about actually deleting them and why deleting them fixes it, but I've noticed that when I delete them, very rarely does it seem to have any effect on any settings I've made in the application. There's a few apps where all of a sudden it goes, oh my God, you've never used this app before. You know, do you want to register it? You know, I don't, you know, nothing set up correctly. But a lot of them, it's just like, yeah, okay, whatever. I'm good.
Well, it entirely depends on, as you say, there's not a one-to-one mapping of plist files. If you carefully choose the wrong plist file, you can always, if you delete all plist files for an application, it's always possible to make it forget everything if you delete enough files. You just keep deleting files, it will eventually forget everything, I promise. But a lot of times it will be a separate file for separate things. So there might be one plist file for every account you have set up and stuff like that. So by deleting the, you know, sort of the main plist file, you're probably only affecting very high level settings.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I usually look for the main one first and then back into
exactly.
All the others.
Yeah. So if you will find that there one app tends to have lots and lots of plists.
Right. Right.
So why do they get mucked up was the second question. So we know what they are now. They're just these lists of configuration information. So why do they get mucked up? And the answer is bad programming. It's a bug. It's always a bug.
Hmm.
It's almost never a case that the actual plist file gets corrupted. What actually happens is that some value gets stored in there, and when that value is read out, the app has a conniption and crashes. So the app makes a mistake and writes wrong data in, which it is then unable to deal with when it comes back out at it. So let's say the app is expecting it to be a value of 0 or 1, and it somehow manages to accidentally write minus 47. And the code for dealing with getting it out of the file does not have enough error handling on it, and it just goes, nah, and it dies.
Which is translated into a spinning beach ball of death, usually.
Or simply the app vanishes and crashes. Either of those two extremes, yeah.
Right.
It'll either tie itself in an infinite loop and just beach ball forever, or it will play an old crash, one of the two. But yes, so it's not that the plist file is broken, it's that the app has written bad information into it, and every time it reads out that bad information, it ties itself into a knot again. And the way to stop that happening is to get rid of the bad information by deleting the plist file.
Hmm. Okay.
So it's basically, if a file gets mucked up, if the plist file is causing you trouble, it's because of a bug in the app in the first place.
Okay.
So the plist file is a symptom, not a cause.
You know, I've never kept track of which apps end up needing me to do that. I sort of feel like all of them at one time or another have caused this.
You know,
probably
I don't
not.
Remember the last time I've deleted a plist file.
I do. 32
well,
minutes ago.
I deleted the plist file was 10 minutes ago. But I don't remember the last time I've had to delete a plist file.
Huh.
It's, for me, it just, it's not something that happens, but I don't tend to experiment as much with software these days.
It's the first thing I thought of when they hid the library folder from us was, well, wait a minute, how do I get to the plist file? You know, or yeah, how do I get to the application support folder? That's the other one.
Hold that option.
Yeah. Yeah, I've gotten real good at that now. But I did notice an interesting problem with that. I was trying to, just now, I was messing around in an application called Phrase, trying to open the plist files to read them. But from within Phrase, I can't navigate to the library folder.
Yeah,
no
just
option.
Right click open with.
Yeah, but it doesn't show it
or
in the
drag
list.
Or drag and drop it on Phrase.
It decided that DVDpedia was the application that should open plist files.
Ooh, that's nasty.
Yeah, not quite what DVDpedia is for. It's a great cataloging application for your DVDs.
By the way, I presume you mean Phrase is in the text editor?
Yeah.
Phrase was a branch of Smultron which had been discontinued. The actual Smultron is back, and it's in the App Store.
I think you told us that. I didn't know it was in the App Store, but I think you told us that.
It's back and it's in the App Store. Just FYI, so I'm not a Phrase user anymore. I'm back to being a Smultron user.
Okay.
Which is where I came from in the first place. Anyway, so the last question, why does this voodoo chicken-waving thing of deleting plist files actually work? And the reason is because...
Sorry, chicken waving. I'm picturing you holding up a dead chicken and it waving when the way you said that. Okay, keep going.
Yes, okay.
Why does chicken waving fix this?
Well, when an app starts up, the process is, the first thing it does is it will go to your library folder, look for its name, and look for its plist file. And if it doesn't find one, it will create a default plist file.
Okay.
Which has the effect of reinstalling the app because it puts everything back to default. And whatever buggered up value had gotten in there is now gone because a new one has been created with the default.
So minus 47 goes back to 1 or 2.
1 or 0, exactly, something sensible. So whatever it is that has gotten messed up in there because the app has done something silly to itself is fixed because it's back to a default plist. And this, of course, only fixes problems caused by dodgy values in plists. If the problem is something else, then replacing the plist will not fix the problem. It will only fix the problem of bad data having gotten stored in the plist file in the first place. And this is entirely equivalent to reinstalling an app in Windows. Because
really?
It's very difficult in Windows to go into the registry and delete the keys that belong to a particular app. Whereas when you run the installer, it simply replaces what's in the registry with a fresh copy. And so it's exactly the same as recreating the plist file.
Hmm. That's really
that's the answer.
That's really, really interesting. Yeah, I like that we can do that. That's for sure. One of the things I wanted to tell people, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but it's really relevant right in this conversation, that to me now the easiest way to find the plist for a file, and I did it today when Wiretap Studio was being snotty, was I opened AppDelete Lite from ReggieAshworth.com, and you can also get this in the App Store. AppDelete Lite, all it does is show you what files you could delete if you wanted to choose to delete an application. So the thing it comes up with is a list of all its plists. So instead of scrolling through com.apple.blah blah blah in that folder, you know, where 98% of the stuff in your preferences folder is going to be associated with Apple products, you can actually just go directly to the errant plist. So it showed me five or six plists associated with Wiretap Studio, and AppDelete Lite shows you the path to the file. So all I had to do was click on it, boom, I'm right there. I could delete that one plist and not delete the entire application. And then when I relaunched Wiretap Studio, boom, my recording window was back up and we were in business.
Yes, I guess we should say that the most important plist file for any app is generally found in your library folder. Now, let me just browse to this before I misspeak by accident. So if you go into the Finder, you go to the Go menu, you won't see your library folder until you hold down the Option key when it will magically appear.
Yeah, you have to hold down Option before you click on Go.
No. While it's there, you can press and let go of Option and you'll see it appear and disappear.
Oh. Oh, okay, good. Magic. I thought I had to do it beforehand. Okay.
Yes. And that will take you to your library folder, where there is a folder called Preferences. And in the Preferences folder, you will find pretty much nothing but plists and a few lock files.
Right, but how many files are in that folder for you?
470.
Right. So rather than scrolling through 470,
I'm not saying not to use Reggie's thing at all. I'm just saying that for people who are interested in where these things are kept, the main one for an app is generally in this folder. The app probably has other plist files, but they're going to be in a different place, and they should not be deleted willy-nilly. So the other important folder, if you go back up to the library folder, is a folder called Application Support.
Yeah, that's a really important one.
You will find a folder per application. So there's a folder here for Skype, a folder here for Smultron, a folder here for Text Expander, a folder here for Transmit. If just deleting the plist doesn't work, what I will generally do is I will rename a folder here. Don't go into these folders and delete bits of them. It's an all or nothing kind of thing.
Hmm.
And the chances are lots of these folders contain lots of plists. You're better off not deleting those plists on an individual basis, but just moving the folder out of the way. Well, and that folder will get recreated, and all the plists in it will get recreated.
They also, those folders, definitely don't delete those folders, because they can contain the actual information from your application. So, like,
not just can, do.
Okay, well, not always do. But, I mean, in the case of, like, my feed, everything I've created in Feeder is actually in the application support folder. I can't save that out to another location. It lives in the application support folder. Certainly not all apps. I think things with a database probably is what's the best example.
Yes.
Like DVDpedia that I mentioned. My entire DVDpedia library that I would hang myself if I lost after scanning in 400 DVDs, that's all in the application support folder. So definitely don't delete those folders.
Yes, your Firefox preferences and saved passwords are in Firefox's folder. Your mail is in here if you use Thunderbird in Thunderbird's folder. I think Mail.app keeps it somewhere else.
Yeah.
But if you delete this folder, deleting this folder and the matching plist in the preferences file is equivalent to a complete uninstall.
Right, and deleting of your data in some cases.
Which means that it will be as if you have only just installed the app, which means you are likely to lose. You are going to lose all any custom settings you've made, and any database-like app is likely to lose you your data as well.
Yeah.
So be careful.
Yeah.
And this is why
they hid
the library
it from
folder
us.
Is hidden. And I think Leo Laporte came up with another good reason, is that people were abusing that folder because they thought, library, that must be where I put my books.
Oh, you're kidding.
And so they were making their own little folders in there and storing their audiobooks and stuff in there. And they go, all this junk, I can just get rid of all this junk. These aren't my books. And then breaking their Macs. So, yes, I wholeheartedly approve of hiding the folder, so that only power users who know what they're doing can find it. It's not gone, it's just taken away from people who don't know what they're doing.
There you go.
That's right, in my opinion.
And now all of us know why we need it, where to get it, why we should do it, and we can wag our fingers at them because of bad programming now. We even know why.
Yes, if deleleting your plist fixes a problem, there's a bug in the application.
Wow. Excellent. Really, that was way more than I would have gotten by reading Wikipedia about plists.
Well, Wikipedia pages are all about the intricacies of the process. The fact that it will store NS string, NS number, NS date, NS data, NS array, and NS dictionary objects, for example.
Yeah, useful. I read that part. I read about how it changed to XML. I'm going, okay, this isn't helping me at all. I can sound like a real know-it-all, but I still won't know the answer to any of Pierre's questions.
Yeah, I'm actually quite disappointed by this Wikipedia page because it's entirely about the what, about the why.
Yeah. Well, you can edit it, you know.
Yeah, I know. Then I should, but not today.
All right, Bart. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. It's fun to be back in the swing of things with you and on our schedule again.
Yes, so every second week again, touch wood.
There you go.
Okay, so until 2 weeks from now, happy computing.
Well, the chat room's going wild right now, going, yay, Bart is back on Chit-Chat Across the Pond. As always, we had a great time, and I learned a lot, that's for sure. Save me the trouble of learning anything on my own, and having him spoon-feed me was great. Well, last week I asked if you would take a moment and drop a comment in on iTunes, and Ken Wolf did just that. Thank you so much for such a lovely review. Remember, everybody, you don't have to say nice things. Just go say something, would you? We need more comments. Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills, ScreenSteps, and Smile. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Heck, look me up in Google+. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.